this, and actually I don't know anything about copolymers. And I would be interested if somebody can, I think there was a mistyping in the title. So I will talk about variational methods for hydrodynamics. But if so, probably this is the title of somebody else, and I would be interested in. But it seems, I think I vaguely heard about. Yeah. So are there people really working on copolymers here?
Good.
Okay, so there is no damage.
No damage yet. <laughs> So
I will talk about a more classical topics, which is some variational topics on hydrodynamics. Okay, so before starting the lecture, I would like to make some kind of short historical background of that, right? So let me some few words about the. So the model I will discuss is the Euler equation for incompressible fluids. So this means exactly this is a Navier-Stokes equation without viscosity. So it doesn't fully enter the famous list of problems. But Euler is also interesting. So the equation was designed by Euler in 1755. And from the mathematical point of view, I think that the first PDE work on that goes back to Liechtenstein. And this is quite far in the past because it's in 1925. Okay? And this is more or less in the style of nonlinear evolution PDE. And therefore, it is quite far from variational problems. And of course, there has been a lot of work after that. And you can get a nice review on this specific aspect in several books. For instance, the books I know are the book by Jean-Yves Chemin, for instance. And it is also partly discussed in the book of Pierre-Louis Lyons at Oxford University Press. If you wish to have an overview with more topics, I would suggest the book of Marchioro and Pulvirenti. And there are many other topics than these aspects. These two books are really focused on the PDE evolution aspects of the Euler equation. This contains more topics about dynamical systems, about statistical mechanics. So it has a richer contain in terms of the global overview on the Euler equation. So a striking paper was published in 1966 by Vladimir Arnold. This was in the Annales Institut Fourier. And he made a new connection between Euler equation and mathematics by pointing out that the Euler equation are actually some geometric equation. You know, Euler equation describes geodesic curves on the group of volume preserving maps. Of course, it is quite possible that this was discovered. Some people thinks that this point of view actually was already more or less known by Lagrange. So I wouldn't discuss the origin of the of this point of view, but it's clear that Arnold was very successful in connecting the Euler equation with Riemannian geometry. And in this paper, for instance, you have several results about the computation of the sectional curvature, for instance, of this group of volume-preserving maps. For instance, he showed that the curvature of this group with the right metric for this problem is neither positive nor negative, so which means that from the dynamical system point of view, the Euler equations are complicated because you cannot rely on theory about, for instance, Riemannian manifold with negative curvature are more or less, there are many properties are known, but the Euler equations are more complicated than that. And so all these topics have been developed in different directions. So I would say that there were some topological aspects which were used in the, for instance, with extension to the magnetohydrodynamic. And this has been reviewed in the book by Arnold and a Canadian colleagues, Hessin, from Toronto. So the title of the book is Topological Methods in Hydrodynamics. It's also a Springer book. There were also something which is not really related, not totally related to the geometrical aspect, but which was very successful, is the stability analysis of flows. And this is still a living domain. For instance, people are still using this kind of analysis for more complicated models, for instance, plasma physics. And for instance, I could quote people like Walter Strauss or Yan Guo, who are still developing this kind of ideas of Euler flows. But of course, there is another problem which was not really discussed in this paper, but this is very natural. Once you know that the Euler equation corresponds to geodesic curves on this group of volume-preserving maps, it is quite interesting from the analysis point of view to look at problems like, can we define shortest paths between two volume-preserving maps? These kind of things. And so I would say this is the combination of analysis and geometry, because of course most of the usual tools of Riemannian geometry breaks down because we are in infinite dimension. So this is really PDE problems, in fact. And so the first important paper on this way was in 1970 by Ebbing and Marsden, where in some sense they revisited the method of the nonlinear evolution PDEs, which were known already in the geometrical framework. And they obtained nice, I would say, local results showing that, for instance, about the identity map, which is clearly the unit element of the group, around the identity map you can define more or less correctly the geodesical flow. You can show that close to the identity map you can define, between two points that are close enough to the identity map, you can define a unique shortest path and that kind of results. And they clearly, this kind of result clearly belongs to the framework of a local smooth solution of evolution PDEs. This is the kind of methodology they used. So this is the local results about geodesics. And it's local not only in terms of size, it's local in terms of space, because as we will see later, the Euler equations are linked to the L2 metric, which is very, very weak in some sense, the L2 norm. And this result relies on nonlinear evolution PE technique, which involve, for smooth solution of Euler equation, which involve much stronger norms. For instance, you have to control some Lipschitz norm, and therefore the work of Evin Marsden was made in Sobolev spaces, of not in L2. So it's doubly local. It's local in the sense that things should be small, but they should be small in higher norms than the L2 norm. Okay, so I should put that on the side, because this is certainly not a major problem in this field. It's just a marginal problem, but I think it's interesting and it is clearly variational. So this shortest path problem. And the first striking result was obtained in 1985 by Alexander Schnirelmann. And actually, he showed that if you take fluids moving in a box, so if we consider flows in the unit cube, and so we consider the group of volume-preserving diffeomorphism of this unit cube, you can find a pair of points on this group. So you can find two volume-preserving, very smooth maps for which that you can connect with a nice path. But there is no shortest path. That is, the infimum is not achieved. There are pairs of volume preserving, of smooth volume preserving, let's say, diffeomorphism that can be connected by paths of finite length. But by no path of minimal length.
What does such a connection mean in terms of the Euler equations?
Well, it means just that you can find, let's say, a smooth divergence-free vector field, and if you integrate the integral curves from the first map to the... then you can reach the second map with a smooth, a nice, divergence-free vector field. And this doesn't need to be a solution of the Euler equation, of course. So the fact that there is no minimizer doesn't mean that there are no smooth solution of the Euler equation connecting the two points. I'm really talking about minimal length. Is this what you meant?
Just in terms of solutions of the Euler equation.
Yeah, so it doesn't prevent... It just say that there is no shortest path, and if there was a shortest path, a smooth shortest path, this would be a solution to the Euler equation. But it doesn't tell you that there is no another solution of the Euler equation making the path with a longer length, which is not a minimal path, but this would be a critical point for the length, for the distance, but not an infimum. Is it?
Okay. One of these finite entropy paths that doesn't solve the Euler equation, it would solve some sort of equation with additional forces thrown in, right? I mean, with sort of artificial forces.
Oh, you mean the one connecting the... if you wish, yeah. Yeah, yeah, you can say that.
So
that's right.
You're willing to put extra forces into the problem, then?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. That's right. And therefore, I think this result was enough to justify the analysis of this problem. I mean, what to do in the case where the existence of a shortest path fails. So what's the reason for that? And this is what I am going to discuss in this lectures. and there will be some byproducts. So maybe I can continue a little bit the history. So this was a negative result, and so I was involved in this problem a little bit later, and so there was some kind of natural idea of generalized solution for this problem, and it's fairly easy to show the existence of this generalized solution. But that's not very satisfactory because we have to know whether they are meaningful or not. And so, finally, I would say that after sometimes, then I was able to show that in the three-dimensional case, this generalized shortest path actually obeys not the classical Euler equation, but a set of equations that you can consider that generalized Euler equation, but actually, in the most interesting case, they can be shown to correspond to some singular limit of the Euler equation. They correspond essentially to the singular limit of the Euler equation you obtain when you take a parallelepipedic domain and you squeeze one of the dimension. And you pass to the limit formally. And this corresponds to something which is very well known in the modeling of geophysical flows, which is called the hydrostatic assumption. And actually, it turns out that finally this funny generalized solution are more or less just solution of this rescaled Euler equation. So the end of the story is rather satisfactory because you get a set of optimality equations that are consistent with equations that are not the Euler equation but that are used in the modeling of fluids. And there is an additional interesting result, is the uniqueness. There is a uniqueness result, not for the generalized solution itself, because for shortest path problem, in general, there is no uniqueness. You cannot expect to have uniqueness of shortest path. I mean, on the Earth, we know, this is a very special example, but on the Earth, we know that there is no uniqueness like that. But the interesting thing, the second interesting object in the Euler equation is not the velocity field, but the pressure field. And the pressure field corresponds to the normal vector, to the geodesic. And for this quantity, there is a uniqueness result. So it means that physically, the acceleration field, when you wish to move from one volume-preserving map to another one through a shortest path or a generalized shortest path, there may be several ways to do it, but there will be just one acceleration field which will make it. I should say that this is a three-dimensional theory because, in some sense, in this problem, this problem is very different from the evolution problem for the Euler equation. That is, the hard case is not the 3D case, as it is for the evolution PD problem. The hard case is a 2D case. And the solution I obtained was really for the three-dimensional problem because there is a miracle in 3D that we can convexify this minimization problem. So, actually, the resulting problem is just a kind of infinite-dimensional linear program. And this is why the uniqueness of the pressure field is so easy to obtain. But in the 2D case is much more constrained because two-dimensional fluid motion are much more constrained than three-dimensional fluid motions. And you cannot get rid of the topology in some sense, as in 3D. I guess you can interpret that as the fact that the Sobolev embedding is not as good in 3D as in 2D. So in some sense, we are lucky, because thanks to that, we can get rid of the topological problems in 3D, not in 2D. And it seems that it's only recently that Schneeleman has announced a solution to the 2D problem using braids. I mean, combining the ideas of generalized solution, but putting some more constraints about the trajectory of the particles in order to keep track of how they they move around each other. So a good concept for that is to use braids. And so he has announced recently the existence of an optimal solution for the shortest path problem in 2D. But this is much more difficult. And I would say that Schneerman doesn't use really PD techniques, and it would be probably a nice work to look at this new result very carefully and to try to make a more PD-style proof of his results. Okay, so this I think this is enough for the...
Use braids of Peterson, the theory of braids and not...
Probably doesn't use a very sophisticated version of that. But, I mean, he keeps in the framework this information about the topology of the trajectories, which is in some sense completely given up in the 3D case. You don't care in the 3D case. So you have a much softer solution in the 3D case than in the 2D case. So it's completely the reverse of the outstanding problem, which is the Cauchy problem for the order equation, which is well known now in 2D and widely open in 3D. Okay, so that was just the introduction. So now let me start doing the real thing. Okay, so in this lecture, I will use the notation D will be the domain of the fluid. And this will be essentially the unit cube in D dimension, or more generally, the closure of a bounded open convex set. The convexity is just to make some statement easier. However, I mean, it's probably important to keep a simple topology for the domain of the fluid, because it is not clear how the theory should be extended to domain with have some topology or to manifolds, for instance. So I will concentrate on this kind of very simple sets. So I will use the letter G for something which is usually denoted by S diff of D. This is the standard notation, but G is more compact, so I will use G. And this will be the set of diffeomorphism of D, which are volume and orientation preserving. So for a diffeomorphism, a good way to say that the map is both volume and orientation preserving, to say that the Jacobian determinant is equal to 1. So the determinant of this matrix, so I will use it, is 1 for all x. Okay, here I don't give a precise definition of the amount of smoothness I need here, because it's not so important for the rest of the talk, but you could consider that this is C1 or C infinity, or even Lipschitz would be fine, provided that you replace this for all x by for almost every x. Okay, so this is the group of volume and orientation preserving diffeomorphism of D. And this is a natural configuration space for an incompressible fluid. So an incompressible fluid can be described as a curve, a time-dependent curve in G that is a continuous family of volume-preserving maps telling you, so this is an incompressible flow, and since it's a map, you can write also GT of X for all X, and GT of X can be seen as a position at time t of a fluid particle parcel labeled by X, and traditionally we choose as a label for the particle the initial position, the position at a given time, which is zero for simplicity, located at X in D at T is equal to zero. So if you prefer, zero and X is equal to X. And here, X is in D and T is in some given time interval. Okay? And of course, this configuration space is included in a larger space, which I will denote by S, which is a set of volume-preserving map in the sense of measure theory. So the definition is the following. So this is a map, let's say a Borel map, if you wish. Borel measure map. Such that, instead of this differential relation, you keep the integral version of that, which means that if you take any continuous function phi, when you compute this integral, you should recover the integral of phi on D. Okay? Because, of course, if the Jacobian determinant is equal to 1, you get this formula. So this is a larger set, much larger set. And because... So first of all, it's much larger because you lose a nice property of this set. This was called G because it's a group under the composition rule. If you take two such diffeomorphisms, the composition of these two diffeomorphisms will still be a diffeomorphism with Jacobian determinant equal to 1. So it's a group, and you can invert. But here, you lose the inversion property. I mean, these maps do not need to be one-to-one. So, but of course, you keep the composition property, so this is a semi-group. This is only a semi-group. And preserving maps. And this has an interesting consequence. Sorry? Well, I mean, the problem with this infinite dimensional object that it's always awkward to try to make them Lie group because that's a part of the difficulty, and in some sense, it's a little bit arrogant statement. It's almost misleading to try to put this to try fanatically to use the same concept at infinite dimension. Because, I mean, this is like the when we will see the metric aspect, this will not make a Riemannian manifold. Because, I mean, this is infinite dimension, and there is lack of compactness all the time, so we cannot define the topology are never the right one. I mean, nothing works properly. So in some sense, I cannot tell you very precisely the answer to your question because it's almost irrelevant to me in some sense. But okay, so let me give you some examples. So for instance, if D is equal to 1, of course G is reduced to the identity map. Right? Because this is the only map of the unit interval, so D is 0, 1. And of course, there is just one map, which is orientation and volume preserving on the unit interval. So it's completely empty. S is not at all empty. S contains many maps. So let me draw some graphs of such maps. So, for instance, you can have an orientation reversing map like this. So this is because this formula will still be true. Okay? So this is orientation reversing. So another example is this one, which is discontinuous. And a more interesting example is the hat function, like this, with slope plus 2 and minus 2, right? Because this also satisfies this formula. I mean, you can check that by splitting this integral in two parts and using the change of variable on the two half interval and using that the Jacobian determinant is 2 and you get 1 half and blah, blah, blah. So this is still in S. But now if you consider the case D equal to 3, as a matter of fact, there is a clear tensor product for property for S, and you can lift all these maps to the 3D case. So, for instance, I can define H of x1, x2, x3 to be gamma of x1 for one any of these three maps, for instance, x2 and x3. This will be in S of z1 to the 3. So these one-dimensional maps can be also considered as three-dimensional volume-preserving maps. And the interesting point is that if you consider the strong L2 topology, this S will be the closure of G for all dimension bigger than 1. So you have a theorem saying, which belongs to the folklore of, dynamical system theory, that for D equal to the unit cube with D strictly larger than 1, S is closed in L2. And is the closure of G. And so I will explain this result in a more general result in one of the lectures. It's L2 closure. So which means that any a map like this, which is just a one-dimensional crazy map like that, extended like this in 3D, can be approximated by a sequence of volume-preserving orientation and volume-preserving diffeomorphism. In particular, this one. I mean, it also means that orientation-reversing map, I mean, the lifted to the 3 dimension, this would be a nice diffeomorphism, but orientation-reversing. This can be approximated in an L2 sense by a sequence of orientation-volume-preserving maps. So it is not so surprising because the L2 norm is not very strong. But the point is that to define the Euler equation, the metric we are going to use is the L2 metric. It's not the H1 or H50 metric. It's the L2 metric. So we have to keep in mind that the configuration space of an incompressible fluid, we have to be careful about our view on it, because it could be, if we think in terms of completion, we may have to consider the maps like that, which are very far from the classical volume preserving, orientation preserving diffeomorphism. Okay. Yeah, so now I'm going to this point. So now what's the link with the Euler equation? Okay, so we have this domain and the group which is included in S. So I remind you that this is a set of maps such that you have this change of formula variable, change of variable formula for all continuous phi. And of course, you can see that as a subspace. I mean, for instance, if you take phi to be the norm, the Euclidean norm squared, you see that this is included in the set of maps such that this quantity is the same as x squared dx, right? You just take phi to be this the Euclidean norm squared. So this means that this is included in a sphere in L2, actually. This, you can see that as a subset of a sphere in the space of L2 function from D into RD, because D is a subset of RD. So this is, of course, a naive point of view that you couldn't use if D was a manifold. But since D is just a piece of RD, let's consider G as a subset of a sphere. So you have the Hilbert space H, we call that H, and we have on this sphere this set G, or so it's hard. I have no idea about how it looks, but this is floating around on this group. And therefore, with this naive picture, immediately you have a naive concept of geodesic curves, because this is just embedded in the space L2, and so at least formally you can define a geodesic distance between two points, G0 and G1, by considering, so define the geodesic distance. So I should put distance with quotes, because this number in principle could be infinite between G0, G1 given in G, or in S, if you prefer, as D sub G of G0, G1 is equal to the infimum of the length. So how can we measure the length? But we consider path, and we compute just the L2 norm of the time derivative. So this will be G prime of T, where I denote by prime the derivative, L2 dt, for all path G connecting, so this is from 0 to 1, connecting G0 and G1, and such that G of t is in G at all time between 0 and 1, right? This is a naive way, okay.
What time do you think to be able to take in boundary values?
For at the moment, there you don't consider boundary values, because I consider maps that are mapping the domain into itself. So this corresponds physically to a closed box where there is no flux going inside or outside of the box.
It would seem, in the one-dimensional case, it would make more sense to do it with periodic boundary conditions.
Oh, you mean like a circle?
Right.
Yeah, that's right. But if you stay... Well, you could do that. Yeah, that's right. I would be... You have to be a little bit careful about the topology, because it's not complete. You know, you have to be careful about the shift along the circle. And so this is why...
restriction the field to the boundary, because what's the trace
theorem? But in this case, the one-dimensional case, if I consider the group of volume preserving diffeomorphism, will be very simple, because you will get only translation. G will be just a one-parameter family of functions, so it's not so a big extension of the unit interval. For the torus is more is a little bit trickier. Actually, I started doing the theory on the torus, but this was dangerous, because you have to keep track of some topology on the torus. And so this is a tentative definition of the geodesic distance between two points. Of course, this infimum could be infinite if you cannot find a path with finite length. So I guess you are familiar with the trick that when you define the geodesic distance, you can substitute this is with the power 1, but we can use the same definition with power 2, which is more convenient for the variational analysis, provided you put a square root with the same condition. You know, this is a usual trick. These two numbers are the same, because when you minimize the square, this is the same as minimizing the length, but prescribing that the norm of t prime of t is constant in time. So this is a different way of... You could do that for all... for geodesics in the finite dimensional case also. So I prefer this definition. So this is a formal definition, and this gives a possibility of defining. So you can say that G valued in G is a geodesic curve if for all, so in a given time interval I, for all T0, T1 in I sufficiently close, then we have the integral of g of t prime square in L2 dt from T0 to T1 is smaller than what you would get for any other curve connecting G0, G of T0, and G of T1 along the group of volume preserving maps. So for all paths in G such that G twiddle T0 is equal to G of T0 and G twiddle of T1 is equal to G of T1. Right? And it turns out that the Euler equation precisely describes the geodesic curve in this sense. So maybe it is time to write the Euler equations. So we can say that a curve in G satisfies the Euler equations if there is a scalar field from E cross D to R, which is called the pressure, such that the acceleration of each particle, so which is for all particle in the domain D, if you compute the second order time derivative of G with respect to T, this can be considered the acceleration of the particle, right? And this is given. This acceleration is given by the gradient of this scalar field. So there you have, and the convention is to put a minus. So this will be given by minus grad p, computed at the location of the particle. So this is the Euler equation, and grad p, of course, this is the notation for dx1p, dxdp of t. Right. So, of course, intuitively, it is... The statement is a little bit strange because if there exists such a P, of course, you see that the Euler equation describes curves that are constrained by this constraint to be volume-preserving. So you cannot expect... The simplest model would be to consider that there is no acceleration. But this would be incompatible in general with the fact that it's volume preserving, because no acceleration means that particles fly with constant velocity. And of course, if you have particles with constant velocity, they will focus in general, and so it's impossible to preserve the volume. So you need something to balance the acceleration, and the Euler equation tells you that to balance this acceleration, you need to have a potential force field. That's it. This is the only thing with the Euler equation. Of course, this writing is not the usual writing of the Euler equation, although it was, as far as I remember, it was in the original papers. But precisely, Euler made a tremendous invention to introduce a velocity field. And so the invention was so successful that now people have forgotten that the origin of the equation is like that. But so the fantastic idea of Euler was to say that, well, I mean, now in modern terms, since G is a family of diffeomorphism, we can define V in an implicit fashion by assuming that everything is smooth. Implicitly by Vt of Gtx is equal to the first order time derivative. Okay? So because G is a 1-to-1 in x, you can define that. And once you have introduced V, you can get rid of G. That's the good point with the. So this is the Eulerian velocity. And it's very elementary by derivative this expression with respect to t to see that you get dtv plus v dot. This is a scalar product, the inner product in Rd. V dot grad v plus grad p is u. But now, so we have got rid of G, but we have to keep in mind that G must satisfy the volume-preserving constraint, and this, for the velocity field, becomes the famous divergence-free condition. Plus a boundary, since we already talked about the boundary condition, the volume-preserving condition implies that V is not only divergence free but also is tangent to the boundary. That is, and V is parallel to the boundary of the domain G. And this is the Euler equation in the so-called Eulerian form. And they are widely known like this. I mean, this is the standard. If you look at the textbook, this is the standard way of writing the Euler equation. But now you have a very easy theorem. Actually, very easy. This is just an application of the one-dimensional Poincaré inequality. The theorem tells the following. So let GP be a smooth solution to the Euler, to be a smooth solution to the Euler equation in D, let's say in the time interval I cross D, and define lambda to be the largest, such that when you take the second derivative of the pressure field in space, right, at, and multiply by some, and you look at the associated quadratic form, so time psi j is less than lambda norm of psi squared. This is the Euclidean norm for all psi in Rd. Sorry. So this is the, and all t in the time interval, and all x in d. So this is the largest value of the largest eigenvalue of the Hessian matrix of P. So we assume that the Hessian matrix of P is bounded by lambda everywhere in this time interval in this domain D. So of course this needs some smoothness on P. But not so much, actually. You can see, for instance, that P could be have a very, very negative values, for instance, the Hessian matrix. This will be still compatible with the result. So let me continue the statements on the left blackboard before I stop. Okay. Then, for all time interval, for all T0, T1 in the time interval I, such that lambda T1 is larger than T0 and lambda T1 minus T0 square is less than pi square, right? Then we have that the when you compute the velocity, the L2 norm of the velocity space-time on this interval, this will be less, strictly less than for all other, for all G Tweedle, let's say from I to G, which coincide with G at time 0 and time T0 and T1, and of course, unless G is equal to G Tweedle on this time interval. Okay, so if you take a smooth solution of the Euler equation on any sufficiently short interval defined by this quantity, you satisfy this minimization property, which proves that the smooth solution of the Euler equation is a geodesic curve. That smooth solution okay, and so I don't know, probably the time is over now. Yeah, so I should stop here for today. I mean, you can try to do that. This is really an elementary exercise to do. You have just, I mean, I give just the hint, and you can try to do it for tomorrow. You look at this quantity. Where P is the pressure. You do a Taylor expansion about G. You expand that. You use the one-dimensional Poincaré inequality in time. And you use the fact that G and G Tweedle are volume preserving. And then you conclude it quite easily. So I think this is really doable. And Taylor expand. Okay, thank you.